Well, we haven't talked very much about Noah in the last couple of weeks. We've been talking about all kinds of other stuff, but this is an interesting thing that came up this week. You may wonder, what in the world is that? I don't know, some of you older people will remember. 1959, I think it was, when this was first made known, when half of you won't fit this. This was some sort of space up on top of mountains in Turkey that was kind of shaped like a boat, and people were thinking, is that the remnants of Noah's Ark? So, believe it or not, recently someone has gone and investigated it with ground penetrating radar, right? Now, this is what it looked like in 1961 on the left, and another picture taken in 2019. And looking at it from the side, it looks a little more regular, but this ground penetrating radar showed some interesting features underground. They say that the red there and the different colors show organic material in a pattern underneath the soil, underneath the ground. This is something that they don't think should happen. I'll look at, you can see this is a little more closely at the that one space there. It's not something that would happen by accident. It looks like there's a structure down there of some kind, figuring that it may be the remains of the cages and so on that have rotted away, but there's still organic material underground. Look at this one where you can see that the lines that they're picking up are very geometric and rather than just random. So they're wondering if this isn't some sort of remnant from the ark on Ararat. And looking at it here, they say that this looks like there's some sort of rows of something. So this just came up this week on my news feed, and interesting. But we can't necessarily use this to verify scripture, but we think it's just God showing us that, yeah, it's true. You know what I mean? So as we've been going through, we're not going to go back and review what we said the first week, but we're going to pick up a few things that we mentioned last week and expand on them. We talked a little bit about, this is the Grand Canyon, and as I was reading about the Grand Canyon, there's something called the Great Unconformity, which is a strange term, but it's that granite base at the on the earth underneath all this dirt that we've been talking about, the sedimentary soil and so on. Right at the bottom of the canyon, they're saying that it's all worn down to the great unconformity, and then all this deposit is on top of it. But all these layers contain fossils, all the layers. Now, we talked a little bit about the fact that right across North America, there are these huge deposits of sandstone. But it's not just sandstone. There's also shale and limestone. And it looks like it has been deposited from an east to west direction, which you would expect if it were tides, because as the tides rise and fall, they move towards the west. Because some of the deposit in the west, for example, at the Death Valley, contain minerals and so on, which would have originally come from the East Coast, specifically the Smoky Mountains. But we talked about, in addition to that, something called mega sequences, which were large deposits over a series of deposits. There was a Salk mega sequence, and then there was The tip of canoe. You like that one, right? That funny name. Then there was the Kaskia, and then the Absatoka. I don't know who they are named after. I don't even know the language. There's a Zuni, and then there was another one, which was very, very thin and doesn't show up very much, called the Teya. These mega sequences are actually layers of deposits of soil and now rock, sand, mostly made up of limestone, shale, and sandstone, sedimentary rock. Now, it just stands to reason that this isn't not something that happens just incidentally. There's got to have been a lot of water to have this much sediment. Do you know what I'm talking about? Sedimentary means there's water and stuff is settling at the bottom of the water. Now, you'll notice that the different layers, especially the first two, the tip of canoe and the sock, are very thick because the water would be quite deep at first. These are as many as 3 miles deep. That's 5 kilometers deep, these deposits. So that's a tremendous amount of material in North America. And every one of these contain fossils. And we're going to talk about that a little bit more. But we see this all over the world. You can see, if we talked about this, and especially there with Cyprus, those are called rhythmites, which would be deposits laid down regularly. Now, tell me, why do we say that these were done quickly? Why would they have been done over a short period of time rather than a long period of time? Yes? Because there's nothing between the layers. It's laid down and they're straight lines, right? If they had been left to sit for a long time, there would be a buildup of dirt. Animals would get at it. Trees would grow in it. Erosion. And they'd be all over the place. But because they're laid down quickly, then they don't have that. And we're seeing something that maybe looks better here. This is Drumheller, Alberta. I don't know, has anyone ever been out to Drumheller? Have you visited the museum there? Yeah. By the way, they're trying to get rid of the town mascot. Apparently it's reached the end of its life and they want to tear it down and get rid of it, the big old dinosaur. And in South Dakota Badlands. Now, the interesting thing about these is that they show the two aspects of the flood that we were talking about. There's an undulatory phase where everything is flooded and that produces the layers. And then there's a recessive stage where the water pours out and wears it away. And it wears it away while it's still fairly soft. And you see these formations are formed. But this is interesting. This is inside the Drumheller Museum. And I've got a statement here from a lady in Great Britain who's got a news report on it. And I'm going to read it here. She says, an ancient riverbed in Canada has been dubbed the River of Death after more than 10,000 dinosaur bones were found at the site. Skulls, hips, ribs, and femurs are often unearthed at the location of the dig on a hillside in Alberta, and studies show they all date back to a single moment 72 million years ago. She was probably there. She added that the fossilized remains of the herd of dinosaurs revealed a tragic tale. We know they all died at once in some kind of catastrophic event. We know that whatever killed them wiped out almost every member of the herd indiscriminately, big, little, old, and young. This is Professor Bramford. The scientists at the site believe a flash flood, possibly caused by a monsoon or a hurricane, may have triggered a deluge that trapped the vast herd of animals which are on their way northward for the summer. The large, heavy animals would have been ill-equipped to survive such a rapid downpour. Scientists believe 10,000 dinosaurs perished in one day as a consequence of freak weather, which probably flooded a popular migration route. We believe this was a herd on a seasonal migration that got tangled up in some catastrophic event that effectively wiped out, if not the entire herd, then a good proportion of it, Professor Bramford told BBC News. These animals are not able to move very fast because of their sheer numbers, and they're very top-heavy, and really not very good at swimming at all. Stones at the site, get this, also capture evidence of turbulent water, indicating the power and destruction of the flood. They're right on the edge, aren't they? North America is a rich area for paleontologists and scientists working on fish fossils in North Dakota. Have recently found evidence that the Chicxulub meteorite, which wiped out almost all dinosaurs 66 million years ago, probably hit Earth in the springtime of the Northern Hemisphere. Well, anyway. So they're talking about North Dakota. These are some of the things. And they find that there's some of these predator fish, large fish, are in the digs in North Dakota, right? And they say here the discovery of shark teeth so far inland has led paleontologists to reconstruct ocean currents, ancient coastlines, and prehistoric climate conditions. And they believe that there was a large lake that went all the way up from the Gulf of Mexico right up to the Arctic, where all these, it was pretty large that we know of anyway, pretty well covered the earth, right? So they strain to make sure they don't really acknowledge the worldwide flood, and yet the evidence is there. The fact that every country in the world has these layers of sedimentary rock with all kinds of fossils and so on. We're going to talk about that a little bit later. But then we talked about the fact that some of these layers don't seem to be so regular. They're all over the place. Why would that be? Well, because there wasn't just a flood. There was also evidence of many volcanic eruptions, earthquakes, and tremendous strain of the earth and producing some of these. They would be formed originally like all the others, but then with the strain and so on, they'd be bent as they were very soft. And so we looked at this passage from Psalm 104 that says, "He set the earth on its foundations so it should never be moved. You covered it with the deep as with a garment. The waters stood above the mountains. At your rebuke they fled. At the sound of your thunder they took flight. The mountains rose, the valleys sank down to the place that you appointed for them. You set a boundary that they may not pass, so that they may not again cover the earth." So, let's just remind ourselves also of this next little bit before we get into some new stuff. Remember we talked about tectonic plates because we've been noticing on the news feeds that there's a lot of volcanic, or I should say earthquakes up along the shore here. The red indicates where there's a priority for earthquakes and tsunamis. And of course, when it comes close to land, that's when people are in danger. Out in the middle of the ocean isn't so much. But these tectonic plates are still moving, and even young Earth scientists believe that that was the case for around the time of the flood. So we said that it looks like these continents actually fit together. Well, they did, but in a way that we wouldn't normally think. Using magnetic fields and so on, they find that these areas have at some time or other been in this orientation and then have gradually moved around. The only difference between young Earth scientists and old Earth scientists is the number of time to do this. But God, in creation, did it in a day. It took him one day to make the earth come up out of the ocean. And here he was given a whole year to do it, right? And in the meantime, Noah was coasting above. I have determined to make an end of all flesh, for the earth is filled with violence through them. Behold, I will destroy them with a flood, destroy them with the earth. And we mentioned last week that this word with also means by. So not only were they destroyed with the earth, but they were destroyed by the earth as it moved, and much turmoil on the earth itself. And so it would have looked something like this as it grew until it finally became what we know it today. Young earth scientists agree with this. And so I'm not a, it's not my specialty. I have to take their word for it. So let's get into some stuff. What haven't we talked about yet? What about fossils, right? By the way, we talked a little bit about the age of the earth. Where is it? I was had a comment about how old the rocks were and so on. And they use a form of age determination called, in, like in seismology. And I'm sorry, I've lost my page here. I just want to make sure I cover this because people are wondering about the age of the earth and how do they know it's so old. So there's a... they use what's called radiometric dating. And I can't explain it to you, but there's something we have to be very careful about. They know that when there's a seismic activity, like an earthquake and so on, and it travels through the earth, it causes cracks in the rocks. And they can determine how old the rocks are by how long it takes for the cracks to travel. And so they use seismology and radiometric dating, and they found that it takes 100 million years to travel across the United States. 100 million years, right? But here's the problem. Sound travels at, 700 miles per hour or something like that. So we find that it takes less than 5 seconds to travel a mile. So it would take about 3.5 hours for a seismic activity to travel across the United States. But they say it takes 100 million years by radiometric dating. So it isn't reliable. And they don't see the contradiction in this. So... they don't want to acknowledge a young earth, so they have to find something to make sure it's old. And so that's why they say that these tectonic plates traveled around over a period of millions of years, because they don't want to acknowledge that God could have done that just in a year. We're going to talk about carbon-14 dating in a few minutes, because it's not reliable as well. Anyway, let's get into... these guys, fossils. There are fossils everywhere through the world. And that's understandable, but the thing is, there's so many of them. How are fossils formed? Well, when something is buried quickly, then it's sealed off from the oxygen, and it's sealed off from predators, and it's sealed in the soil, and then with the weight of soil and the lack of oxygen, it's basically preserved, and then the minerals in the soil then leach into the bones and so on and turns into rock, like petrified, right? Now, I remember watching a video, I think it was at the Science Center in Toronto, where they showed how this whale fell to the bottom of the ocean and died. and gradually dirt built up around it and eventually covered it, and that's how fossils are formed, right? What's the problem with that? Because as long as it's exposed, there are lots of critters down there that are going to eat away at that carcass, and there won't be anything left, including of the bones. It has to be covered to keep it away from anything that would destroy it. So that's why all of a sudden this year, I have never read this before, that they agree that all of these animals that are now fossils were buried immediately. I've never heard a scientist say that before. And they say that, and we talked about that with these dinosaurs. So over time, more sediment builds on top, the buried remains, and then no oxygen, pressure, and the minerals in the soil. Scientists have always said that it takes millions of years, but it doesn't. We have shown that fossilization can happen in a very short period of time. There are different types of fossils. There's what's called trace fossils. You can see here that's some sort of a dinosaur hoof, and there's lots of those around. They just discovered what they thought was a pathway where they traveled back and forth in England, and they found a lot of dinosaur prints of different kinds. There's also there's a bird prints right in the rock. When the prints are made, then they solidify. Dogs, camel, bird, those are called trace fossils, showing the presence of animals. But then there's the actual body fossils, which are the result of their bones and bodies. Now, when you look at the sedimentary layers, these things are in all of these sedimentary layers. And we'll talk about the Grand Canyon again in a few minutes. So, but it's not just the geologists. Remember we talked last week about the fact that geologists maintain that in order to study geology, they have to understand that it was over millions and millions of years, and it's not in a short period of time. Well, paleontologists have the same problem. They say that it takes a long time for things like bones to become fossils. But the other thing is, they say they've always understood that the soft tissue, like our skin, our innards, and so on, eventually dissipate. There's nothing left after a few thousand years. And so they haven't paid any attention to it. But recently, since 2005, they said that they understand that soft tissues and biomolecules, such as proteins, lipids, sugars, don't necessarily break down. They found a dinosaur in which they have found body material, soft material. And there's a Dr. Schweitzer and a team covering said it was really remarkable that this Torontosaurus rex fossil contained soft tissue still. And yet we know that it doesn't survive. They said this has survived 68 million years. Now, let's think about this. How did they get that age? So here we go into carbon 14. I hope you understand what I'm going to say. Every living thing, whether plant, animal, or people, takes in carbon. All right. We breathe in and we eat it and so on, and we maintain it in our bodies. Now, carbon consists of atoms that are two types. There's carbon 12, which is the standard carbon. It's got 12 electrons. And there's carbon 14. It's got too many, two electrons too many. So it's not stable. It eventually loses those two extra electrons. And what they found that when they test carbon content of something living, that as a over a period of time, they can see how old something is by the amount of carbon-14 that's left. It takes over 5,700 years for half of the carbon-14 to degenerate and lose those two, and it becomes actually nitrogen-14. It doesn't become carbon-12. It degenerates into nitrogen-14, and they can then test and see how much there is in it, and on that basis, they date it. They say, well, it started out like everybody else. Now it's only got this much carbon-14, therefore that's how old it is. If there's only half left, it must be 5,700 years old. If there's only a quarter of it left, then it's been twice as long, 11,400 years, and so on, right? But the oldest they can find using carbon-14 dating is maybe up to 50,000 years old, if there's anything on the earth that's that old. But they can't go any further because there'd be so little carbon-14 in the material, it wouldn't be doing. So here's something to think about. Where does carbon-14 come from? It's an aberration from normal carbon. Could it be because it's because of ultraviolet light? Now, what if when God created the earth and we had this protective canopy of whatever it was so that there was no rain or anything all the time, it was just a mist at night? What if there was no ultraviolet light for the first 1,700 years? And everything was made just using carbon-12, then anything that you read would have very little carbon-14 in it, and they'd say it would be very, very old, right? And yet, it started out with not much carbon-14 at all. So we don't know how things were in the past. You can't make those assumptions. You don't know how much it started out having. And young Earth creationists are saying that carbon-14 is not a valid way to measure the age of something. I hope that makes sense to you. Been many years since I was in the classroom with that stuff. So we want to talk then about all these fossils. Here's what science portrays as the age of the Earth and the different stages. Notice that down here it started 4.6 billion years ago. I don't know who was around then to find that out, but then the first couple billion years, nothing happened. And not much happened in this level. Now, these are kind of the basic level of granite on the Earth. All these are layers of sedimentary rock on top of it, okay? And they say these came every few million years. So they don't really start until the Cambrian period, which is around 500,000 years ago. This is the conventional long Earth scientists. Now, Cambrian, that's the age of the trilobites. Now, a trilobite looks something like this. These are shelled animals. They're deep sea animals of some kind. You don't see much anymore. Then there's the Ordovician period. It's called the age of the invertebrates. That would be things like crabs and so on. Then there's the Silurian, which is the age of the reefs. Then the Devonian, which is the age of fishes. Then there's the Mississippian age, which is the age of the tropical seas. Pennsylvanian age, which is the age of coal swamps. And then the Permian age, which is the age of Pangaea, and that's when they said that we had this big one blob of Earth. and so on. We'll come back to that. But this is the old Earth paradigm. Each layer represents a stage in the evolution of life on Earth over the billions of years, right? How do you counter that? Well, the fact is, when you look at it, each layer represents sedimentary deposits containing fossils starting from life in very deep water at the bottom and moving in towards land. Then there's a mixture of aquatic and terrestrial life and eventually ending up with fossils, mostly of life on the land at the top. So these fossils are way down deep. And it includes sponges things that don't move around very much, very primitive life, but they're way down deep. Clams, trilobites, starfish, sea cucumbers. Then the next layer up contains coral, brachiopods, deep water nautiloids. Now, a nautiloid looks like this. It's a long thing, like an octopus, very fast-moving predator. There are deep water nautiloids, and then there's shallow water nautiloids. And those are in the second layer, the Ordovician. Then the Silurian layer contains sea scorpions and more nautiloids. And then the next layer is trees and other plants. Pennsylvania layer contains reptiles, mollusks, starfish, and trilobites. And then as we move up, we find that there's more plant life and there's more life from on top of the Earth. And what young Earth scientists are saying is these are not signifying different ages. They're signifying things that lived at the same time but lived in different areas of the ocean. So think about this. Suppose there's great turmoil. Not only is the water coming down and there's water pouring up from the depths, but there's also a tremendous amount of soil and so on moving around. The first thing that's going to be buried is something at the bottom of the ocean, right? And the next thing that's going to be buried is something that's farther up. And in that year, when things are in tremendous turmoil, things that are going to die and get buried are going to get shallower and shallower until finally it's going to be things on top of the Earth, which are animals and trees and so on. So that's the young Earth paradigm. These are not ages, but actually things that lived in different territories at the same time producing all these fossils. That make sense? Does to me too, but we look at the diagram of, this is the Grand Canyon, and they've got what they say are the different ages that there's the Paleozoic. Paleozoic was kind of the old paleo just means ancient. So there's nautiloids. What in the world are nautiloids from the ocean doing in the Grand Canyon, right? Where did all these shells come from? I think they just have they're blind. And then the Mesozoic is the Middle Age, and they say that all this in the Grand Canyon is from the very early part, the Paleo. Paleo means ancient. Meso means middle, and the Seno means recent, that's all, right? So you recognize Jurassic. It's probably a word every one of us has heard. Well, they're saying that that's from about 150 million years ago. We say, no, they're all the same time. Any questions or comments on that? Yes? Right, okay. Oh, I see. Right. But the thing is, the land that's showing gets larger, but in order to do that, there has to be deeper wells in the ocean to drain the water off into as well, right? So overall, there isn't that much difference in actual volume of the earth. It's just that it shifted in location. And you know, I was reading this week. They say that they found that there is more water under the mantle of the earth than there is in all of the oceans on top of the earth, which is amazing, right? And?
But when you think, if you come with a worldview that you want to cram that billions of years into, you're going to find something that you pretend explains it, even though you know it doesn't. Like, these scientists can't be this stupid.
You're right. It's a worldview that determines what we see, right?
Absolutely. It's either biblical or it's worldview.
Yep.
And I mean, the nonsense that's there, and I mean, you can't really be scientific if you're that foolish.
No. Yeah.
There's nothing scientific about
it. We're accused of being unscientific. But, yeah. Mm-hmm. I didn't talk about that, but I'm going to talk a little bit about it in a few minutes, but they have, we're going to talk about the fact that there's a lot of animals that are extinct in the flood or just shortly afterwards, but I don't know why. I don't know. I don't think it's necessarily because man came along and killed them all. But a lot of them, of course, died in the flood. There would have been only two of anything that this did survive. But I don't know. I haven't studied up on that at all. I picked the craziest picture. Like, the world treats the flood and the ark as a silly cartoon, right? And even when we try to make it look half decent, they still don't show it properly, right? And there are, I was reading somewhere that about a third of the inhabitants of the United States believe that in evolutionary theory, right? About a third of the U.S. citizens believe that God created the earth, but he did it over a long period of time. And then about a third of the United States believe that God did it in a short period of time and that the flood is true. So I don't know, I'm not sure that I can even have the confidence in Canada that we have that sense that that many believe. But what do we know about the ark? Let's read Genesis chapter 6, 14 to 22.
Make yourself an ark of gopher wood. Make rooms in the ark and cover it inside and out with pitch. And this is how you are to make it: the length of the ark, 300 cubits, its breadth, 50 cubits. Its height, 30 cubits. Make a roof for the ark and finish it to a cubit above, and set the door of the ark in its side. Make it with lower, second, and third decks. For behold, I will bring a flood of waters upon the earth to destroy all flesh, in which is the breath of life under heaven. Everything that is on the earth shall die. But I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall come into the ark, you, your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives with you, and every living thing of all flesh. You shall bring two of every sort into the ark to keep them alive with you. It shall be male and female, of the birds according to their kinds, and of the animals according to their kinds, of every creeping thing of the ground according to its kind. Two of every sort shall come into you to keep them alive. take with you every sort of food that is eaten and store it up. It shall serve as food for you and for them. Noah did this. He did all that God commanded.
So how big was the ark? Right. That's about 450 feet, about 3 football fields in length. And it's about 75 feet wide and about 50 feet high. It'll hold approximately 483 semi-trucks. Apparently Noah did that just to show it. Anyway, 483 semi-trucks. That's quite a bit of space. And the marvel is that 8 people looked after it all, right? So there were 3 decks, 3 levels. I imagine Noah and his family would want to stay on the top level, right? So what animals did he bring on board? There's the question. Excuse me. Right now, we know of about 8 million species of animals. 8 million. How come they could get all those on the ark? Pardon?
They wouldn't have needed all of them.
Okay.
They only needed 2 of
every kind. All right. So it's kinds we're dealing with. Most of those species, even most of those kinds, are aquatic. He's not going to put whales on the ark or sharks and so on, right? If you've ever looked at pictures of stuff that's in the ocean, it's amazing. The variety that's in the ocean that would never have to go on the ark. I think the other thing is, what about insects? I just can't imagine Noah going out and getting a male and female mosquito to bring on the ark, right? And so on. I'm not sure about the insects, but it's very likely that a lot of those would have survived in the egg or larva stage during that year, right? So that just brings down an awful lot of the different critters that could be on the earth. Now, what kind of animals does it say are supposed to get on the earth? Did you read that? Talks about birds, yeah. Right. Anything that has the breath of. So, some people aren't too sure whether that included insects or not. They need air, naturally. But they may not have to be ones that were included. And there's some amphibians. Like, what about turtles? Do turtles have to be kept out of the water? You know? There's a debate about among biblical scholars, both Christian and Jews, about the number of clean animals. Is it 7 pairs or is it 7 animals? If it's 7 pairs, that would be 14 of every clean animal and every bird. If it's just 7, it's only 7, they have 3 pairs plus enough for sacrificing, right? And so we can't settle that, but that would make a huge difference in the number of animals. There are 400 species of dogs. Species of dogs, but they're all one kind. So he's to bring 1 of every kind, or 2 of every kind, onto the ark. The kind is all those that can interbreed, and a lot of the dog breeds are because people have bred them specifically. But that would include foxes and wolves and so on. Coyotes were a result of interbreeding between a fox and a wolf. There are many different kinds of cats, but they're all one kind. Bats are several different kinds, and several species of each kind, but then bats don't take up much space, right? Yeah.
So, just a thought on genetics.
Mm-hmm.
When species particularize or get suited to their environment, you're actually losing genetic information.
You are.
And when you breed a dog, you're losing information.
Yeah.
So even though you're getting more species, each species has less genetic information in their makeup, which would mean that whatever dog was on the ark would have had a very large amount of genetic information in its body so that it could adapt to all sorts of different conditions after they start reproducing and spreading over the earth. The ones that go into a cold environment maybe have the ability to get more hair or fur or whatever. And so we're 2,000 years, or more, sorry, we're 4,500 years away from that now. All these species have gotten so suited to their environments that they've lost all this information. So we have trouble conceiving of, you know, two dogs being the mother and father of every dog. It's conceivable.
That's the point. That's right. That as they diverse in their characteristics, they lose data in their DNA. That's right. Exactly. So that's true right from creation, that they would have had all this data in their DNA, and possibly right through to the flood, they contained all this information in their DNA. So someone has gone through the trouble of trying to figure out it with all this consideration. First of all, there's the extinct groups, and that would include reptiles and whatever dinosaurs there are. There's a lot, right? There's almost as many extinct groups as there are living groups today. But these would have been on the ark at some time, and then become extinct later. We don't know why. Maybe because of climate. Dinosaurs maybe were very... before the flood... We were talking about the whole earth being in a temperate zone, right? Maybe they couldn't stand the extreme heat and cold, and that's why we lost a lot of them. There are some forms of dinosaurs that are still alive. But the other thing is, when they look at the Antarctic, they find fossils there of tropical plants and animals. So at some point in the past, the Antarctic was part of this larger part of the world. So they're saying that this person figured there could be maybe 6,744 animals on board. Well, that's a lot less than 8 million. And maybe it's doable. And a lot of those would be small, right? And even if they did bring on animals like dinosaurs, they wouldn't have to bring in adults. They bring in babies for several reasons. They would have eaten less, take up less space, and would have a longer reproductive life after they get off the ark. So it's an advantage to have the younger ones there. So what did he have to do to bring on food? Well, by the way, there's someone else has done another calculation of the same sort of thing, not as detailed, and they came up with within 14, the same number, almost, of animals on the ark. And what was he supposed to do about food? How long did he have to gather the food? And what food was it? Pardon? Vegetables. How do you know that? Pardon? Right. At creation, God says the fruit of the trees and the vegetables are for you and for the animals to eat. There was no... animals didn't eat each other, apparently, because it was at the flood. After the flood, then man was said that he could eat meat. And that the animals would be in fear of man, but also that they believe that animals then started eating animals. So it would be basically a vegetation diet. They would need water, so they probably had to store a lot of water. But the thing that comes to my mind is that if God really wanted to, he could have put the animals into hibernation for a year. Look what he did with the lions when Daniel was in the lion's den. What if they ran low on food? Well, what did he do with feeding the 5,000? What about the widow's cruse of oil or with Elisha? Or the widow's barrel of flour with Elijah? You know, God's able to do anything. We don't have to try and do the work that God was doing here. He knew what he was doing. He had given Noah the instructions. The world finds all kinds of ways to discount what God does, but we don't have to rationalize it. We have to trust him for what he says. It's interesting, I know, to explain some of these things, but shouldn't be a source of our faith. So that's a brief discovery of things that I have found out. You got any questions or comments, then now's your time.